Well, I'm pleased with a lot of the players. I mentioned this when the squad was gathered together, first of all, that I was going to try and utilise this. I didn't want people starting to feel that because we picked a team on Friday night that was my first thoughts. Far from it. And by the time we get round to September, of course, lots of things can happen in that time.
Well, the O'Neill Keane Dream Team era has got off to a good start. Beauty and the Beast, maybe, with beautiful football at home against Latvia and beast-like doggedness away to Poland. This is the Why Big Football Show. I'm Dave O'Grady. We have a real Irish football Christmas present of a show for you tonight. We'll be talking to an Irish UEFA coach based in Sweden about the structures of grassroots in Ireland compared to the rest of Europe. FAI Cup champion Sligo Rovers launched their season tickets for 2014. Yes, the West's awake, and I'll be speaking to their media officer Rory Houston on how the club hopes to capture the support from the whole of Connacht. We'll also be looking at how Irish soccer coverage has become a giant on Twitter with hashtags such as #coybig. That's come on you boys in green. If you'd like to mail the show, it's dave@talkingsport.org. We're also talkingsport.org on Twitter and talkingsport.org on Facebook. It's that simple. But as Craig David would say, can I get a rewind and let's just go back to Poland and Latvia. And I'm delighted to be joined by Joe McCarthy of the Irish Abroad website and Peter Staunton of Goal Ireland. Lads, you're very welcome. Joe, to come to yourself first. What two games for the new management team. As I said, beauty and the beast, a terrific performance against Latvia, followed by doggedness against Poland in Poznan. The return to Poznan, as they say, Joe. A lot better this time than at the Euros.
Yeah. I was watching the match and I was just thinking it doesn't seem so long ago that I was standing behind the goal on the right as we watched it on the telly when Sean St. Ledger scored. I think in retrospect, the two games were probably fairly ideal for the new management team to get bedded in. I think some people were saying, you know, maybe Latvia were a weakened side, but I'd prefer that we went out and played well against them and tried to implement some of the new ideas rather than maybe invite a strong side like maybe Italy or someone here, and we end up getting destroyed and just right back at square one. So I think the Latvia game was a good starting point. I think the players were able to show what they've been able to learn or what they've been able to implement the new ideas from Roy and Martin over the last kind of the week and the build up to it. There was a lot of positives that came out of it in comparison with the previous regime. And then Poland, as you say, a very different side to Latvia and away from home as well, which we don't see very often in friendlies. I think we had to go there. I think it's one of those games that we had to go and grind out a result, and we got it. I think a 0-0 was a fair result on both sides. The pitch, I think, wasn't in great condition, but it was again just a different proposition to Latvia. And again, I think the lads, the management side team, will possibly learn more from that game than from the Latvia win. It just gives us a good starting off point. I think the next big date on the calendar is the draw for the European qualifiers at the end of February. And then the first home game after that is a friendly against Serbia in March. So we'll see how things go between then and now. I'm looking forward to seeing both Martin and Roy at games across England up till then, and maybe recruiting one or two more players into the team.
Yeah, exciting times. Peter Staunton, to come to yourself. Very positive for the players. Martin O'Neill, of course, used the whole squad. I think everybody got a run out, maybe bar Rob Elliott, the third goalkeeper. But he'll be sending them back to their clubs, happy in their nappies. There'll be no Moni Michaels. Everybody got a run. Everybody went out there to prove a point.
Yeah, it seems we're still very much in the honeymoon period. So everybody should be encouraged by the start that O'Neill, and indeed, I suppose, Roy Keane made. It's hard to mention O'Neill without mentioning Keane these days. From the new departure point of view, it's interesting to see him using Mark Wilson, for example, as a central defender, and then talking in glowing terms about Wilson afterwards. He's used him there in the two games, and it looks like that once John O'Shea obviously is back in contention in the competitive games, which are, a good bit down the road now, it has to be said. That could be a partnership that could be looked upon. Also, another few minutes or another two performances under the belt from James McCarthy in centre midfield. And you can see the instructions that Roy Keane was trying to give him from the sidelines last night as well. You know, he's got to be the type of player that Roy Keane is going to try and mould into maybe not the same type of vocal presence on the pitch, but certainly the same type of influence once he's on the ball, calming things down and using it in the right areas. Also, it's interesting to see two different approaches that they used up front as well. You know, obviously, as Joe mentioned there, the Poland game is probably a bigger indicator of what's to come. Obviously, we're not going to be playing teams like Latvia all the time, and we're going to have to go away to places which are going to be very, very difficult. And to be able to have the discipline in terms of positioning and, you know, in that eagerness to battle for every header that Shane Long showed against Poland, that's going to be vitally important. But, yeah, very, very encouraging that everybody gets a run out. And yeah, everybody's happy so far. Nobody's been on the tweet machine so far, that's for sure.
Yeah, let's be careful with that one. Paul Green, Peter, spoke about a little bit of a nervousness between the team. Everybody, it was like they were on trials at the training camp. And one of the key points I think we all have to remember is this wasn't Martin O'Neill's team that he selected. This team was selected by Noel King. And at the end of the day, when it comes to March, it could be indeed a very different team. So maybe that played some part in keeping the players on their toes.
Yeah, as you said, it's Noel King's squad. And in that respect, it's much like walking into to a club job before a transfer window where, you know, you're kind of forced to make do with what you have until the window opens. And then, you know, you can start to put your own stamp on things. Once that window opens, you can bring your own players in. That said, there isn't an awful lot of players who, you know, since the end of the Trapattoni regime and the players that he excluded, there hasn't been an awful lot of those players who still haven't had their chance to come back in there. So as far as our talent pool goes, unless you're delving right down into the under-21s and maybe waiting for the likes of maybe Brady and Hendrick to come back from injury fully, and maybe Paddy Madden too, I don't think there's an awful lot more players that these guys, that Keane and O'Neill can look at. Some players will be playing for their futures. You know, I don't know if we'd expect to see, you know, Kevin Doyle and Stephen Ward in the Ireland reckoning by the time the qualifiers roll around for the Euros. And Paul Green will probably include himself in that as well. But it's fair to say he did himself no harm with a really, I wouldn't say composed, but certainly an assured, aggressive, tenacious performance against
Poland. Was his type of game, Peter, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, pure Sunday League stuff. They went down to the ground.
I think the one thing we could look at after these two games is, as you say, is you know, what players are going to come into the squad and what are going to move on. You know, Peter made the point there that it is 12 months before the first qualifier. You know, before the first real important game comes along, and there's a lot in the side that are aging. I mean, Richard Dunn is out with a knock at the moment. You know, by the time he comes back, you know, by the time the qualifiers come around, he'll be 12 months older. And then by the time the European Championships start, you know, he'll be 2 years on top of that. And Robbie Keane is very much in the same situation. So what I'd like to see for the next squad against Serbia in March is maybe looking at the younger options. Now, we mentioned Mark Wilson being given a run at centre-half yesterday against Poland. And also, you know, he got a chance in central midfield. I felt he performed a little bit better in centre-half than in central midfield. I think that's where he used to play for Portsmouth when he was coming through as a youth player. But again, he was encouraging to see that kind of experimentation coming from the side, despite maybe not being very familiar with how Mark Wilson likes to play. I think Kieran Clark obviously will be given a chance at centre-half. You know, he got his debut at Aston Villa under Martin O'Neill. I think the long-term, probably the problem position for us, as it has been for a long time, is going to be left full. You know, Stephen Ward was given a chance to play there in the last two games. Didn't do too badly, but I think we've seen from him in the past that he can come up short at international level against some of the better sides. He is playing regularly now for Brighton in the Championship, so there is something to look for to maybe keep an eye on in the future. Just noted as well that Stephen Hunt signed a short-term deal with Ipswich, and he actually played at left full for them in his first game. He didn't play the full 90 minutes. I think he's obviously just a little bit short of match fitness. But, you know, again, might be an option there in future. And I know that Peter just mentioned the under-21s there. I think Derek Williams played as left full for them in their two qualifiers against the Faroe Islands, and in the 0-0 draw with Montenegro last night.
He's playing with Bristol at the moment, and it's down in League One. Might be one for the long term, but I think, you know, at that kind of level, you know, there's obviously players playing as a better level or a higher level that could be looked at. Roy Keane was also very enthusiastic about the League of Ireland, and I think obviously that there's a wealth of talent there, has been evidenced by the number of players who have moved to England and have gone from that into the senior side. And I'd hope that they would look to promote the game at a national level as well.
Absolutely, I would agree with Joe there. We did see that with King, you know, in the last squad when he brought in some of the League of Ireland players to train with him. And certainly I don't think the likes of Richie Towell at Dundalk, for example, would be, you know, too far beneath the standard that we have. I mean, he's been at Celtic, so he does know the ins and outs of the game. So I think it would be an encouraging sign if these players remained on the radar of Keane and O'Neill, as they have been on the radar for King. And I think it is very, very important to maintain that link, you know, to keep people interested, to keep the League of Ireland fans on side, of course. But also, you never know when you're going to uncover the next star. And just in the last, you know, in the last few weeks, we've seen players go over. Obviously, you've had Daryl Horgan going over to Torquay on a trial. Barry McNamee at Brentford. So, you know, the talent is there. And it's just a matter of exploiting it and developing it before it has to go cross-channel. Because, you know, not to use too wild an example, but if you look at Nigeria, for example, you know, they won the African Cup of Nations. And this is a team who've been looking abroad for talent for a long, 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 long time. And then all of a sudden, Stephen Cation comes in and he picks six home-based players from the Nigerian League, which is, you know, probably worse than the League of Ireland, and end up winning the African Cup of Nations. So it just shows you what can be done when a connection is maintained with the League of Ireland.
And it was great to hear Martin O'Neill actually say that in his press conference, where he was hoping to maybe unearth talent that might have been missed by the English clubs. Something that I think Roddy Collins or Pat Dolan or one of them actually completely poo-pooed.
Yeah, I mean, Trapattoni was always fond of saying, I mean, I was a great defender of Trapattoni, I have to say, but he was fond of saying that, you know, there's no league in Ireland, which is disheartening for, you know, everybody that's involved with the clubs in the country, and also probably is a shot across the bows for the likes of Coleman and McLean, because, you know, they've, and Keith Fahey and people like that, because they've kicked around the League of Ireland, they know what it's like. And you know, one of the chief criticisms against the critics of the League of Ireland is they don't recognise, you know, the level of competition and the standard that it's at. Okay, granted, it's in the last maybe year or two, it's maybe dipped comparatively when you take into account European results. But there's still a damn sight of talent in that league, and it definitely deserves to be looked at. And who knows, we might even get a left back out of it as well.
Peter, just to bring you up on a point on a lot of the positives, Martin O'Neill spoke after the Poland game of a number of positives that he learned, a lot of players that he feels now that he can work with. Just highlighting some of them, the performance of James McLean was like his early days at Sunderland. It was really incredible. Aidan McGeady's cutting inside style and rejuvenation, if you could call it that. And as Joe was saying, Mark Wilson as a centre-back, he looked very, very good. And I know Martin O'Neill was impressed with him.
Yeah, we do have options on the wings. It's probably where we're strongest, actually. You know, when you think of McGeady and McLean and Robbie Brady as well, you know, you do have, you know, talent to call upon. You know, you've got your pace, your trickery, set-piece ability as well, that a lot of other international nations can count upon, nations that would deem themselves much stronger than we are. And especially with Brady, McLean and McGeady, they're the type of players who can crisscross over, cut inside. You know, there's a good mix of left-footed, right-footed. And I certainly would say that if we're going to get any football out of this team competitively going forward, then that's where our strength is primarily going to lie. I have to agree with Trapattoni on the playmaker front. I don't think we do have one capable of dictating a game, running a game. So that means for me that primarily our threat is going to have to come down the flanks. But luckily we're blessed with that. And we've good headers of the ball in the centre as well. Walters, Long, Stokes, people like that. So I would say, yeah, the flanks, very, very encouraging, especially the performance against Latvia of McLean. I thought he was really, really good. And Wilson, yeah, I do see his long-term future now with the Irish team in centre-back. It seems to be what O'Neill had in mind over these last two games. And he has spoken in glowing terms about Wilson in the press between yesterday and today about the type of player he can become for Ireland. And as Joe noted earlier on with Richard Dunne, not getting any younger, and the competition for places, you know, really not exactly hotting up. I mean, the likes of Alex Pearce and Richard Keogh, you know, you could count them as contenders, but are they ever going to be those excellent central defenders that we had in the past? I don't know. Sean St. Leger just simply can't be relied upon due to his injuries anymore. So there definitely is a spot open for Wilson, and provided he can keep his head, keep that concentration, he could be the solution to our problems in there.
Just what Peter was saying there about, you know, the creativity on the side coming from to the flanks. I think that, you know, with the players we have in the squad at the moment, you mentioned McLean and McGeady, obviously Brady and Pilkington are out injured at the moment as well, and maybe someone like Jack Grealish in future. I think it's, you know, one player that I actually did want to see, and unfortunately wasn't able to due to injury, was Stephen Quinn, who's very much a central midfield player and has that little bit of a creative spark that I think we might have been lacking through the centre of the park in the last few years. Obviously, you know, the name that always comes up when people talk about that is Stephen Ireland, and, you know, he's made the usual noises at Stoke that, you know, he wants to concentrate on his club game, and then maybe you think about that when the qualifiers start rolling around next year. But you know, he definitely can bring something to the table that we are missing. I think it's just unfortunate that Wes Hoolahan, you know, might have missed out, and maybe in the last 2 or 3 years especially, the amount of game time he, you know, probably should have gotten. I think he showed against Latvia what he can do with the ball at his feet. Was unlucky to not to score as well with a late shot. So I think while everything is positive from the first two games, you know, I think, you know, just to, maybe we should keep in mind as well that it's still very much the honeymoon period. I'm really looking forward to seeing what the two lads can do, with the players that they have, and obviously the experience that they both have in football. And it's overall, I think it's a very positive looking future for Irish football at the moment.
And Joel, do you think Martin O'Neill and Roy Keane are going to go on a bit of a recruitment drive now? Maybe look at players that aren't in the squad. I know we argued that, okay, fair enough, Noel King picked the squad, but at the same time you could say that there was only a few players that we might have had in instead of the current crop. But nevertheless, is there a chance that we might have a recruitment drive? Maybe some new Irish blood might emerge in the Premier League, Championship, and, you know, around the place, and that'll be something that Martin and Roy will get their hands dirty with and see who's there.
I think, you know, when you come to the end of any qualification period, you know, there's a natural kind of drop off from the senior members of the squad, and I hope that they'd look at, you know, who is, you know, as Peter said, who, you know, who's not getting any younger, and what squad positions do we look to replace. I'm not really sure what players are available. I know there was talk in the papers of the Chelsea striker Patrick Bamford. He's out on loan at the moment, but he's just actually been called into the England U21 squad, so I'm not sure if that will rule him out in future. I think I'd look at promotion maybe from the U21 side, which has long been the main role of the U21 squad to you know, prepare players for that final step into senior international football. I think on the wider scale of things, you know, maybe we should start looking at beyond England as a recruitment an area for recruitment. You know, there's long been talk of, you know, maybe looking in the States for players who are Irish qualified, and I think Australia could become one in the future. I know that Noel King spoke to the Colorado Rapids player Shane O'Neill. He's originally from Cork, but his parents emigrated at a very, very young age. I think he's a naturalized American now. He plays for their under 20 squad. And you know, again, you know, the MSL, you know, people, you know, debate its merits and its strengths as a league. But, you know, Robbie Keane is playing there, and he's playing very as well as I can remember him playing at international level. You know, the States are going to the World Cup, and excuse me, you know, they have players like Clint Dempsey in their squad, who I think would be a shoo-in for the Ireland team.
Sorry, Joe, I don't know if we'd have to go so far abroad at this stage. I know we've had a fair few granny rulers in the past, and there's no doubt about it, obviously, with MLS developing the way it is, that there are players who are going to be Irish qualified in there. But I do think while we have the elite pathway up and running, in name at least, I think we should look to that just to make sure that players aren't put off and, you know, aren't disheartened, in fact, by you know, players been parachuted in into the senior side after they do all the hard work and come through the underage teams. I give the example again of Richie Towell, who capped Ireland sort of at every level from about under 17 all the way up to under 21, and then he gets on the fringes, or goes to Celtic on the fringes there, gets to play at Hibs, and then any pathway into the Ireland senior team is blocked by Paul Green, who gets called into the Ireland squad the first time at the age of 26. So I do think it's a little bit harsh on the guys who put the hard yards in at the underage levels that they don't really get a chance to show what they can do at senior level, because ultimately that's where the trust has to be given to them. And you look at the Germany team that beat England the other night, you know, all those players coming through the DFB youth promotion systems all around Germany, and they don't mind if a player is good enough, and as then he automatically commands the respect of the manager, and Joachim Löw is preparing a team to go and win the World Cup, and he still has no qualms about putting kids of 2021 in. So I wouldn't mind seeing that emulated, because there is a little bit of talent, you know, the in the under 21 squad. The boy at Millwall, Aidan O'Brien, has scored plenty of goals at that level. You know, obviously the likes of Jack Grealish, Samuel Carruthers, and Sean Murray, and you know Derek Williams, who's really highly regarded as well, and obviously Shane Duffy, who's coming up on 20 caps at that level. I'd imagine, you know, these are the type of guys that I think we should look to next. Bring them in, let them have a few training sessions, see how they're developing, give them a run in friendlies, and see where we go from there.
And in theory, Peter, if that was the case, which we have seen in the past with the likes of Robbie Brady and Jeff Hendrick, if that was the case, then it would bring about even more excitement for watching the Irish under-21s.
Oh, definitely. I don't think anybody could dispute that Brady and Brady especially and Hendrick have been successes since they've come into the senior panel. And it's always good. It always gives people a bit of a jolt, fans and players alike, when there's competition for places around. And I think when Trapattoni was looking for the likes of Alex Pearce and Richard Keogh and Paul Green, people were a little bit disheartened and going, my God, have we not got anybody better than these guys? So, you know, to bring somebody through and have an identification with the Irish team from a young age, to say that you saw a guy, you know, playing the showgrounds at under 19 and then seeing him in a World Cup qualifier away in France or something like that, you know, something to be proud of, and there's an identification process at play there.
What about that, Joe? Would you go along with that? Maybe we should be looking to promote from the under-21s. We see the likes of Jack Grealish, Samir Carruthers, Sean Murray, Callum Riley. There's loads of them. Or should we be looking for lads that are eligible for Ireland? And should the reason not be you should be putting your best team on the pitch?
I suppose it is a bit of a catch-22 situation.
I mean, let me just put this point to you, what Michael O'Neill said about Northern Ireland this week. He came out saying how he scoured the Premier League, Championship, League One, even League Two, for anybody that was born in England, Wales, Scotland, even the Republic of Ireland, for if there was any ties to Northern Ireland in it, and they had a couple of players that might have, and then they discovered there wasn't. And Michael O'Neill, he was a little bit disappointed that there was a lack of people with ties, you know, to Northern Ireland, but because of the lack of quality, I suppose, in their team and the lack of depth that they have, he's willing to open the gates to anybody and everybody, come into the party, as he would say. Should we not be doing that? Would we be better if we took an approach like that? Or would you agree with Peter, you know, we should have boundaries?
I don't think we should go that far. I mean, like Peter said, seeing players come through the youth ranks and then go on to play for the international side and qualifiers or even at championships creates a sense of identity. And, you know, pulling in players who might not have had any link to the country. I'm not just talking about Ireland now, I mean just international football in general. I think does create a barrier or a sense that, you know, it's not about playing for the country, it's just about playing international football. If you just look at the example maybe of Alex Bruce, who, you know, had capped by Trapattoni under for the Republic, and I was at a B game in Derrymount against Nottingham Forest, and he definitely started. I think he might have even captained the team, but then decided he wanted to play for the North. And you can see things like that in future, you know, degrading the international game, which is supposed to be the highest echelons of football, you know, at the World Cup. Whereas, you know, it's just making a little bit. Maybe turning into a little bit like club football, and you know, people will start talking about only you know, mercenary players or what have you. I think that it kind of it's promoting players. It should be the only the right players promoted. If we think they would improve the squad, you know, then by all means bring them in. But I think promoting players just to say that they've promoted players would be a mistake. You know, if we promote the right players into the team and it leads to an improvement in the squad, then that was the right move. Again, you know, when you start thinking of talking about whether or not a certain player who, you know, maybe at 23 or 24 suddenly, you know, decides that he's eligible for Republic of Ireland and wants to play for the national side, it's a situation you have to handle with kid gloves. I think, again, are they going to improve the side? Do you think that this kind of promotion of a player would maybe be a bone of contention among fans? And you know, are there any kind of, is he blocking position for maybe a talented player who might need maybe another 12 months in the under 21s or under 19s? As Peter said, like, are there players in the League of Ireland that could possibly come in and be as good? I don't think there's a simple or a one-off answer for it. And it's something that I don't think Trapattoni grasped as much, maybe because he didn't have that grounding or that Irish football background. And he was willing to approach, say, someone like Alex Pearce or Paul Green because he thought they would improve the side. But obviously, you know, Roy Keane and Martin O'Neill, with their histories with the North and with the Republic, you know, maybe if they were presented at the same option, you know, they might maybe have pause for thought.
And Martin O'Neill said that he'd, regarding the eligibility thing, he is completely open-minded, but for something like that, he will do it the old-fashioned way and sit down, have a cup of tea with the player and see how kind of committed he would be.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's something similar to Roy Keane's. I think when he was manager at Sunderland, I think when he said one of the first things he used to do when he spoke with a player was try and get a judge for their character. You know, would they be... you know, how dedicated they would be to their craft, or how what they would bring to the side. Maybe you should debate the merits of his transfer validity would be another argument, I think, or an argument for another day. But Martin O'Neill has been in the game long enough to know, you know, what qualities a player would bring, and obviously he has his plan for the future of Irish international football, and whether or not a player could be slotted into that. Just when you mentioned what players could be approached, there's no one really that springs to mind. And you know, I think that's obviously, you know, they're going to have to establish whatever their scouting network are. I know Frank Stapleton used to watch players for Trapattoni, but if Michael O'Neill is having that problem, then I can only imagine that that Martin O'Neill and Roy Keane would have, you know, similar problems. Maybe I think that there's an attraction in playing for Roy Keane. You know, he's such a massive name within the game, and obviously Martin O'Neill as well. That playing for them might be part of the attraction of playing for the Republic of Ireland. We just have to wait and see.
Yeah, well, it's for me, it's evident that we're right at the beginning of this entire process. So the way it plays out is very much going to be unfolding before all our eyes as time goes on. And we don't really have an indication of what type of squad Martin O'Neill would even have picked for these two friendly matches. Because obviously, like I said earlier, he's been working with talent that was picked from beyond, which was from Noel King. So I do think that the Serbia game, you know, that will give us a clearer indication of where O'Neill holds certain players in what kind of esteem. Whether it's a mix of under 21 players or whether he's going to go down that route of trying to cap some overseas players, that all kind of remains to be seen, and everything until then is conjecture. From a personal point of view, I have to say I'd rather lose matches with guys who, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, but guys who are Irish and guys who have come through the system, rather than losing with guys who aren't. There's a lot of countries now in that process of renewal. Look at what Louis van Gaal has done to the Dutch team since he went in there. You know, you look at that team, and it's the average age is about 23. There's 7 or 8 of them playing in the Eredivisie, and they're no worse off for it. Crucially, it shows that, you know, with a manager like van Gaal, the key thing is to be able to get his message across. And he's always felt he's able to do that with younger players rather than the older ones. There's a certain more malleability on a younger player who can carry out his instructions greatly. So maybe that is you know, one paradigm that the Ireland team could consider going forward is to use younger guys. Because I do think if you want to get some continuity for 2-3 qualification cycles at a time, you know, you don't really want to be flogging a dead horse all the time, giving senior players injections, making sure they can have one more game, that kind of thing. You do want to be in a process where you can count on, you know, sort of 14, 16 fit, healthy young lads all the time. And if one of them is injured, another one can slot in, no problem. We really haven't reached that stage yet. You know, we do kind of scrabble, you know, we kind of live from hand to mouth when it comes to players, and we're not really blessed with a wealth of options in any one position, other than the wing, as I said. So, you know, so the more players that get tested at this level, the better. Obviously, we've got a year to do so now, more or less, before the next senior fixture. So you would hope that the game in March, and then there's going to be more games, obviously, some teams might prepare against us for the European Championship. So once that becomes about, it's a testing process for ourselves as well. So the more new players that get capped, the better in my book.
And Peter, on a final point, it's good to see if we are getting, say, English-born Irish players, it's great to see that it's happening through the underage structures with Ireland. You know, I know Jack Grealish was on the under-17s team, right, and then he was on under-19s, now he's on under-21s. Young Liam Kelly, who scored that terrific goal, it's fair to say, for the under-19s as well. You know, there's a lot of them, and Noel King and Paul Doolan and a few others, they're doing quite good work in that regard, you know, because at least these players are coming up through our system then.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, our recent record at the underage level, it hasn't been great, it has to be said. There's some really chastening performances and some underwhelming performances, you know, I don't sort that are under 21, under 19 level. So there have been some disappointments. But the important thing is, at that level, is not really results. It's not the, you know, it's not really what Doolan and King are paid for, is to deliver results. They're paid to deliver players for the senior team. Now, in Trapattoni's case, this was always difficult because he wasn't looking to that level. These players who were promising, they almost had to be pushed into his lap before he picked them. So you would hope that O'Neill certainly is going to need to have that cohesiveness and that line of communication open between the 19s and the 21s in order to get the players fed to the senior team. Because you look at any of the successful nations, even relative to their size, they're not the ones that are going from hand to mouth trying to cap players from overseas. These are the countries who are looking at the 19s, looking at their 21s, and trying to bring the elite players through. We tend to forget in this country sometimes that, you know, at the very top level, it's a results business at international football. But the rest of the process is all about developing players. And like I said, the most successful countries in terms of trophies at senior level and the ones who are competing at semi-finals all the time, these are the ones who are developing players properly. Until that gets addressed, Irish football is going to remain exactly where it is.
Well, we hope that things change and change quite soon. And by the Serbia game next March, you never know, we might just have a very, very up-and-coming, quality, exciting team for the Martin O'Neill, Roy Keane era. If you'd like to sponsor, advertise, or simply get involved with any of the shows on talkingsport.org, drop us an email to dave@talkingsport.org. That's dave@talkingsport.org. Now, over the past few years, the social media surrounding the Irish team has reached a whole new level. Hashtag Coybig, come on you boys in green, fronts the debates, comments and punditry on Twitter. Now, we're delighted to have Paul Moriarty, Head of Insight at News Access Media Intelligence, Ireland's media intelligence agency. Paul, you guys compare statistics and run comparisons on events. What have you found from the first two matches of the O'Neill Keane Dream Team era?
Well, it's certainly been a very interesting couple of matches, Dave, in terms of looking at the amount of buzz that can be created, particularly on Twitter. And as you say, the Coybig hashtag is the one that really seems to dominate. The Ireland versus Poland match, which happened most recently, we tracked from around 4 p.m. until midnight on the day of the game. That allows for a little bit of the build-up, the match itself, and then some post-match analysis. On the day of that game, we tracked fact, 1,844 tweets, retweets, and replies for Coibig, which is quite a large amount. That being said, on the Ireland versus Latvia game, the first game under O'Neill and Roy Keane, we tracked 4,306 tweets, retweets, and replies for the same period. So you can just see the difference depending on how much buzz there is around a particular game.
It's unbelievable. I'm quite shocked at that, considering I always thought that if people are in at the match, I think they had around 40,000 at the Latvia game, and obviously there was only 300 Irish fans, there would be a lot more people following the away match because obviously they weren't at the game. But then again, people tweet while they're at it, don't they?
They really do, and this comes down to the notion of social chatter or social buzz, as it's well known, because really that first game with Roy Keane, with Martin O'Neill, generated so much interest. On the game itself, they both generated over 1,000 tweets on that first game. So Martin O'Neill generated in around 950 tweets. Roy Keane, just from mentions of his name, generated 1,381 tweets over that period. So it just shows you, while O'Neill is definitely the boss on that opening game, Roy Keane got people talking, unsurprisingly, some people would say.
Yeah, anytime there's anything, I suppose, controversial in a match or in football or decisions, transfers, that's the kind of thing people talk about on Twitter, more so than the actual game itself. You know, if there's a row or a yellow card, red card, and perhaps say a row between a manager and a fourth official, that's the kind of thing you guys would pick up on a lot, I'd say.
At News Access, I mean, we track right across the course of the game, as I mentioned. And the one thing, I mean, that really, really generates buzz is when a goal is scored. There's no getting away from it. Notwithstanding that, obviously, when a ref makes a controversial decision, lots of people get talking about that as well. I mean, if we look at the running order, as it were, of the other night, the actual peak of the Ireland versus Poland game was at the very beginning. There was a huge peak at 7:42 p.m. as Aaron Levine was played. Some people happy that it wasn't the model Nadia Ford doing the theme that night, which I think created a lot of buzz.
Yeah, yeah.
And the biggest peak of the evening came 2 minutes later, 3 minutes later at 7:45, when the game actually kicked off. The score.ie, that website, tweeted that Poland versus Ireland is underway in Poznan. Follow every kick here. And again, they added their link to their own live feed. That created a lot of buzz, particularly through retweets, which have a real power as well.
Yeah, one of the things I noticed, and I have a couple of friends that weren't actually able to watch the Ireland-Poland match in Poznan, they were saying they were going to follow it on Twitter. So, as you mentioned, people that maybe are not in Ireland or the UK or wherever showing the match, a lot of Irish fans out there around the world, the only way they can follow it is through Twitter. And for someone like thescore.ie and our own Joe McCarthy, he runs an Irish Abroad Twitter page, a great way of following it.
It really is. I mean, and most certainly Ireland, and we can track at News Access the geography of tweets. So we know that on that night, from 4 p.m. until midnight, the night of the Latvia game, almost 2,500 of those original tweets were based in Ireland. In the United States, though, you still had around 600 people tweeting or retweeting. Australia, of course, as well, was well represented with a number of tweets there as well. As far as India, you had Kazakhstan, even somebody retweeted regarding Coibig. So it just shows you it goes right across the world, and people are involved in this big conversation. That's what Twitter is all about, and that's certainly about what monitoring social media and evaluating it, which is what we do, is all about.
We also have Joe McCarthy on the line, and Joe, listening there to Paul, it's obvious how huge Irish football has grown through social media and promotion of stuff. I know on the Irish Abroad Twitter page, you guys follow every Irish player that's in the UK and overseas, further afield across Europe, when they're scoring goals for their clubs and that. But this kind of thing on match days, as Paul was saying, it really does blow up. Are you a little bit surprised at the times of the peaks?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, I know if you look at things like TV ratings, and they can tell you, like, you know, across what periods the most, what times most games are most, what times most people are watching, you know, different parts of the games. I didn't think around the anthem it would be as popular. I did think that the kickoff obviously would have a bit of interest, and maybe again at halftime, you know, people might click over to see the studio analysis, or if they see on Twitter that there's been a goal or a controversial decision, more people watch will click over to the game, and then they start tweeting, and then more people click over, and it's kind of a circle after that. I think it's obviously it shows the wide interest that there is in the Irish football team, not just here at home, but obviously in the diaspora around the world. And you know, we had talked before with a guy in Australia who, you know, out of his own pocket paid to broadcast the Ireland Sweden game. So I think it just kind of reinforces the interest that is there internationally. And you know, maybe that's something the FAI could look at in the future as another way of generating revenue.
Indeed, they can. And Paul, that's a key point that Joe mentioned. A lot of the broadcasters are actually using hashtags like KoiBig or YBig or Arl/Poll or whichever ones the FAI use. A lot of those broadcasters can kind of jump on that and actually get people watching it through their mediums.
They can, of course. I think the interesting thing about Twitter and about the fact that nobody actually has full control over it is that often what you'll find is a broadcaster may say a particular hashtag, but everybody will go with another one, so they can try and influence it. But actually, the way that this form of media works is kind of turning the tables a little bit. It's meaning that the consensus, the majority of the people who are tweeting, get to have control over those hashtags. And it's a really interesting area. It's something that's changing all the time and seeing development. Certainly, as you mentioned, for the Poland game the other night, one of the other leading hashtags was Poll IRL, P-O-L-I-R-L, with up to 656 tweets. And also Live FAI, which was the FAI's own hashtag, also got a few hundred tweets as well. So they are making an effort to get involved in that social media strand.
It's unbelievable. One of the things I noticed, Paul, for TalkingSport.org, I followed the under-21 match on the UEFA site. They were showing a play-by-play text commentary. What I was interested in was the FAI's own Twitter site. They were only showing very little information about the match, maybe, you know, midway through the first half scoring and maybe a half-time score or that. So what I did was I actually got in and I tweeted constant updates about it, and I couldn't believe the amount of new followers that we got in and the amount of people that were interested in it. Not just Irish fans, Paul, but fans from the clubs of the different players that were mentioned. If I mentioned about a certain player doing well and I tagged the actual Premier League or Championship or League One club that the player played for, we got a lot of new followers from those clubs and a lot of interest from all over. So, what you can do here is really phenomenal.
It's the flexibility of tweeting particularly, and also, of course, you know, there's lots of conversation on Facebook and on different websites. Twitter seems to have really, it's got its stronghold at this stage for events like football games, rugby games, Gaelic games, and it does allow you to, I suppose, as well as having the established hashtags, as you say, you kind of took it on yourself to create a bit of a conversation, included the handles of the various players, and it brings you off in a completely different direction. And it's something that not only associations like the FAI, but companies and corporations are well aware of it, and it's becoming more and more important.
Joe, it kind of brings me back to after the Ireland-Faroes game in the Faroe Islands, when I think James of Pogue McGoal, he got together with yourself and a good few other Irish pundits and Irish sports journalists and chaired a conversation on Twitter about a big debate about the match. And what I found was interesting was it wasn't mainstream media that was driving it. Joe, you yourself know from the Irish Abroad site that that's something that's developing all the time.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's been talk of in the last few years that we're seeing the decline in print media and print journalism, and it's starting to become more the realm of bloggers and to some people who obviously use Twitter quite a lot are starting to become the people who generate the news. I think the first real news story that broke on Twitter
was the plane that landed in the Hudson. Excuse me. And I certainly noticed in over the last kind of 18 months that Twitter is where I start to get my news from. You know, depending on the people I follow, you know, that's the kind of news, the kind of stories that I hear first about. And I think that was one of the better descriptions I heard about, I read about Twitter, was that it's basically a customized news feed that you can kind of tailor to your own needs. So if you only want to read about, say, football, then you might follow, journalists from football, but also, you know, fans or fan groups. You know, I follow a good few writers in the States and people like comic book artists as well, because I have an interest in that area. That is really where people are starting to get their news from. I saw a really good documentary in New York Times about a year ago. I think it was called Hold the Front Page. And that was a big part of it, was a discussion among the journalists who were working at the Times, that the move, they had all started to move, or they all had a presence on Twitter, because if they didn't, then something could break and they would miss it.
And Paul, just on incidents that happened in matches, I mean, we were looking at the other match as well, the Portugal-Sweden cracker, Zlatan versus Ronaldo. All of a sudden, nothing's happening for so long, and then all of a sudden, Twitter just balloons. It just goes crazy and out of control. I suppose that's the beauty of it all.
It really is. It can respond within seconds, and that's what makes it so exciting. That's what makes it exciting to monitor it as well, because you just can't tell over the course of a match. You know, anything can happen. I know it's a little bit of a cliche, but the great thing is that rather than in the past, you know, you'd have a water cooler moment the next day in the office and be talking about it, these days, because second screening with your iPad, with your smartphone, has become part and parcel of the experience of a match, it happens instantly. And again, that case, you know, as you mentioned, it was superb, and it resulted in such a flurry of activity. It was quite exciting.
And just finally going back, Paul, to the hashtag KoiBig, what I found really interesting was a lot of Irish fans use it for the pre-match discussions as well, as you were saying, you know, the build-up when, you know, with in the last few games when Trapattoni hasn't been in charge, we've seen the team announced right before kickoff, and it's something that we haven't had in a few years, but that must have generated huge amount, and it's something new to Irish fans, the excitement on Twitter of waiting for a team to be announced, and then when the squad is announced, I think everybody has a team sheet on their Twitter page.
That's it. And again, it's this release of information that happens, and it comes directly to your personal device. KoiBig, you said it, it's now become part and parcel not only of Irish football, it's also for rugby as well. It's something that I suppose is becoming bigger than just the hashtag. It's almost becoming used in general conversation as well, rather than come on you boys in green, it's kind of KoiBig, you know. So it's been a huge success, and kudos to the people who first started using it, because it's really got traction, it's really started to grow.
And just before we let you go, Paul, for anybody looking to have a look at the amazing job with compiling statistics and realization, I suppose, of Twitter, what's the best way for them to check out News Access Media Intelligence?
Check out the website newsaccess.ie, and you'll have details of what we've got there. Also our blog as well is on that, and news updates for what's happening within the company, and at News Access Media on Twitter. You can follow us there, and we're always tweeting little tidbits of information. It's an interesting area, it's a growing area, and you can't beat doing a little bit of monitoring and see what people are talking about during a great game.
Any final predictions for what's around the corner for this whole thing? It's only going to get bigger and bigger, I'd imagine.
Absolutely is. You know, I mean, the reality, I think, for Irish companies, and this is getting into the commercial side of it, is that while it's great fun for us to sit down and monitor the likes of matches or other events which are happening in Ireland or around the world, companies are looking to try and find out what's being said about them on Twitter, on Facebook, and that's what we specialise in, find out what people are saying about them and their competitors and how they compare. So it's a real growth area.
Well, Paul Moriarty, thanks a million for joining us on the Why Big Football Show.
Thanks, Dave.
If you'd like to sponsor, advertise, or simply get involved with any of the shows on TalkingSport.org, drop us an email to dave@TalkingSport.org. That's dave@TalkingSport.org. Now, I'm delighted to be joined by Irish UEFA coach, a writer, and a terrific blogger as well. He's based in Sweden. He's also a terrific journalist. Mark O'Sullivan, thanks a million for joining me on the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, over the past few years, you've been coaching kids from all over Europe, including those from the Espanyol Academy. I understand you're developing new methods of coaching. Tell us a little bit about these new methods and what they entail.
New methods, they're not new methods. Basically, I think every coach has a journey, and my journey is taking me back to the basics, which is spontaneous football, street football, spontaneous athletics, whatever you want to call it. And I feel now, because that whole culture of the spontaneous street football has disappeared, it's caused a big gap in player development, I think. Because it was on the streets we developed our intrinsic motivation and the joy of the game. Sadly, through to cars and commerce, that whole culture has disappeared. And I think that, as Espanyol's academy director said to me, that even at Espanyol, they are seeing it now, and that they have to work more with coordination and balance with kids at very young age, because they're not out playing spontaneous football. They're not out climbing trees. They're not doing what kids used to do. They're not, well, to put it a better word, they're not playing.
Yeah, so you think it's something to do with maybe technology? We also have the influx, I suppose, of video games really taking over society these days, and electronics. Maybe kids don't want to be playing football anymore. And as you said, the whole spontaneity of it is slowly disappearing. It's kind of happening all over Europe over the past few years. Why do you think that has been?
I think it's all about control, really, isn't it? I mean, you know, when I was younger, we played street football. There was free play. That was the normal thing. Then suddenly we become adults and we want to control it. We make it, we organize it, and we totally forget the child in all of us. I think this whole focus on organized football at such a very young age is in some way causing more problems than we think. The coach goes in, coaches young kids, probably overcoaches, thinks he is... I think a good young coach doesn't have to tell players what to do. A good young coach just guides the players, guides them through the game, creates the environment where they enjoy the game, where they develop, have fun, and they play, because that's how kids best learn, is through play. Sadly, with organized football, the play element, that creative aspect of the development of the child, can disappear.
That seems to be very obvious across particularly Ireland and in the UK as well. There seems to be a lack of players coming through with the technical ability. There seems to be an emphasis on speed and strength and maybe how much of an athlete you are, more so as the creative element, as you say, Mark.
Well, that is very true, because I think for me, when somebody says speed, I don't actually think of a guy running fast or a player running fast. I think of how fast did that person make a decision? How quick is he solving problems? And I think that we've lost a lot of that. And how we used to learn that was through spontaneous football, through street football. There was constant decisions to be made. You know, you went out, you played, you different ages played together, you played against a big guy. There's no way you were going to go past him, so you had to figure out a way how to beat him. You were constantly solving problems. And that now, through organized football, is being taken away. And so we need within our coaching to start as early as possible to work with the coupling of perception and action, because all great players, that's what they do. They perceive, they see the situation, they understand, they come up with the solution, and then they do the action. Sadly, there's a great fascination with the action, which is, we say, technique training. We have loads of isolated technique training now. Everyone's a great at technique. But technique means nothing. Nothing unless you're using the right technique, the right time, the right place. I mean, as I said to a friend of mine recently there, I've never seen anyone ever tackled by a cone.
That's true. There's no doubt about that. You mentioned about the big physical players, and, you know, we've seen underage teams across the world, really. There seems to be real physical players seem to be getting in there ahead of the small, skillful and intelligent players. That's something you're working on, changing the mindset of that.
Yeah, well, I think that's quite unique to the Nordic countries and probably to Ireland and England. I mean, if you go to Spain and Portugal and even South America, they don't see things that way at all.
Yeah.
Even if you look at Australia now, I just read their new development plan. Part of the development plan is focusing on perception and decision-making and action. And I think it's really brave that a non-traditional country like Australia is starting to bring in these aspects into their long-term plan. And this will mean that it doesn't matter how big a player or how small a player is, once they possess the qualities to play the game. I think very common in football, I wonder if maybe you've come across it, I've come across it even up here in Scandinavia. They're really working on improving this now, I must say, up there. But I've been in Ireland watching it, and you see a team would lose the game, and the coach responds by saying, we need to be fitter. Not that we need to actually learn to solve the problems better. I need to help these young players solve the problems. How do I do that? We need to be fitter and faster and stronger.
Exactly. I think that's inevitable and it's shown there for all to see. What about the countries that have got it right? I mean, everybody's looking for a model to follow, as they say. People talk about maybe the Spanish model, Portugal, maybe Holland as well. We seem to be getting a lot of Dutch coaches here in Ireland telling us how to play the game and that. And you yourself, you know, with the experience of the Scandinavian countries, Belgium, we've seen the recent success. Who has got it right, do you think, Mark?
I think with player development, one thing we know is that we don't know. we can't tell who's going to become a player. If any one of us could, we would be multimillionaires or very rich football agents. I think the Belgian model is very admirable because they've actually coached coaches on how to observe players, how to watch a player, what to look for in the young player. They have very fine outlines, directives for the coaches to follow, and what to look for and how to develop that. It's a really interesting model and very fascinating to read through. But what's good is Belgium, everyone got on board. Everyone has to be on board. As Germany, the year 2000, they tore the whole thing down.
Yeah, and that's purely because they just simply didn't get out of a group in a major tournament. It wasn't as if it was a total disaster, what was already there.
They saw the problems coming. They saw it coming. They looked into the future and said, this is the way it could go. We need to do something. And Klinsmann was at the forefront of that. And he just, as you said, he tore the whole shop down, eventually got everyone on board. And you just look at it. The Bundesliga has, I think nearly 50% of its players have come through academies. Every team has about 22% of its players come through their academy. The Spanish model, that's a 30-year process, of course, highly influenced by the Dutch with Cruyff. That is another fascinating thing to look at. But I think what's essential, if you're looking from an Irish perspective, is that we look at these, we should examine them, we should learn them, but we also need them to fit in with our culture and our environment. That's what Germany did brilliantly. That is what Belgium did brilliantly. That's what the Spanish did with the Dutch model. They took it and they made it fit into their environment. Iceland are doing it. Iceland came up with a small population. What do? They built small artificial turf pitches next to every school. So what happened? Kids play football. That's a genius move in helping develop football in a country. But they, after studying the German, the Belgian, even the French model, and the Dutch, what can we do to make it better, and how can we make it suit our environment and our climate?
Looking at Ireland and what we have now, I know there has been a lot of work done in at grassroots. That's what we keep reading about and they keep telling us. But at the moment, how do you feel Ireland compares to other countries in Europe that are starting to use this model? I mean, we've seen in recent World Cup qualifiers, we can't compete with the Germanys or we can't compete with the Spains. It's like two completely different eras of footballers coming together on the one pitch almost.
Yeah, it is. Sometimes when you watching Germany at the Aviva, there was like teams playing two different sports at times. Well, it takes long-term planning. It has to be a long-term plan. Are we as a nation, is the Irish nation prepared? Does it have the interest in working with long-term plans? We live in a culture where everything is X factor. instant satisfaction? Do we have the culture? Do we have the patience as a nation, as coaches, as players, as development officers, as a football association, to create a really lasting long-term plan? That's the first question that needs to be asked. And then second, I think what's very important, and from my own experiences of being in Ireland, and actually I started my UEFA B license with the FAI in Ireland, and I decided to finish it in Sweden for various reasons. And I felt that the weakest point in the FAI education for coaches was the pedagogic way of working with the coaches and trying to make the coaches work in a more pedagogic way as well. That the instructors, I felt, didn't have any sense of pedagogy, if you want to use a word. It was PowerPoint presentations, 2 hours of monotonous talking, very little interaction, very little question answers, very little group work. Whereas then I go to Sweden and it's all about the coach. It's all about the ability for us to discuss different topics, debate, work in groups, solve problems in groups. So I think the first thing, in my opinion, from my experience with the FAI, is working with pedagogic abilities of the instructors that coach the coaches and working with the pedagogic abilities of the coaches that are coaching the players. Because that, it's teaching. You're not an instructor, you're a teacher.
Yeah, one of the things in Ireland, and we see it quite a bit in the media, there seems to be a bit of a disconnect from what the FAI are trying to do now and the actual structures that are already in place for, say, schoolboy level in Ireland, where there seems to be a huge emphasis on winning. I watched a recent documentary highlighting a club here in Dublin, and they were, I think, under 14 level. And it was unbelievable how much pressure was put on these young boys. Oh, well, an English club hasn't come in for you yet. You've got to win that game. Nothing's going to happen unless you win this game. So maybe, perhaps, Mark, we're losing a little bit of the football intelligence by having our mindset like that.
Yeah, well, that's the motivation climate the coach creates with the player or with the team. I mean, it's a result-orientated one, or it's, the result-orientated one, obviously, in the long run, will lead to stress because you are constantly comparing yourself to other players, you're comparing yourself to other team, and that it's all about the result, and if the result is not right, then you didn't play well, or you think you didn't play well, and this can lead, in the long run, does, and has been proven, leads to a lot of low self-esteem among players. Performance orientated, that's different, because a performance orientated motivation climate would mean that the player understands that this is a long-term process, as does the coach. They learn the game the right way. They don't compare themselves to other players. They look at their own performance and just try to develop, become the best footballers they can. This takes away the stress out of it. It improves the self-image of the individual and probably of the team as well. So that a performance-orientated model is really, really necessary in any long-term plan for player development, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I think probably a lot of people are saying we should fly away from the dads in charge of teams because they tend to be too self-involved.
Yeah, I guess even from my own point of view, and I have a 5-year-old daughter and a 2-year-old son, I've often thought, God, how emotionally, if I was coaching them, how emotionally involved would I get? Because it's natural as a parent, you get emotionally involved with your own kids. But then you have to step back and say, okay, what's best for my son? What's best for my daughter? And I think that particularly at a young age, all a parent needs to say to a child is, I love watching you play. That's all a child wants to hear. I love watching you play. And that's, you know, at the youngest age, begin with that. And that's your starting point.
One of the major challenges as well, Mark, facing Ireland, I think, is the competition from other sports. Now, I know they say that kids can play all football, GAA sports and rugby as well. There shouldn't be a problem at that age. But there seems to be a bit of a disconnect between maybe the sporting organisations here in Ireland. I know in my local area, it's a case of when you go for the soccer club, you have to go for trials. But if you go to play GAA, they have a team for you.
Joy, it must be fun. Their first contact with the sport, because they arrive at a sport, they have no emotional hook, no emotional attachment, must be a positive experience. So they will come back. And it must be the same for football. Your first contact should not be a trial. That is just utter nonsense. This is
you know, I was listening to some I listened to a lot of radio now from Ireland after Trapattoni got fired, and suddenly we have all these sports journalists who are experts on the biopsychosocial aspects of our kids and suggesting that the best 8-year-olds in Ireland be put on a development plan. That's just complete rubbish. And there is no grounding for that or scientific research behind that backs that. It has to be fun.
Yeah.
You are developing an emotional attachment with the game. That's what the kid is developing, and you are helping him develop that. And you want him to come back. There's a great line by, and he said, if one player doesn't come back next year and gives a football, I have failed as a coach. And I think that is brilliant. And that's what we forget.
Yeah, getting the kids coming back and keeping the fun element in, there's no doubt about it. We have produced a small number of technical players here in Ireland, the likes of Wes Houlihan and that. I suppose players like that, and there's a realisation now that those type of players are playing in League of Ireland, but it always seems to be if they're not big, physical and strong, they tend to be neglected by, say, the big English clubs for a long time. I think the market that Premier League teams seem to view Ireland as is, we'll get the big, strong centre half. And, I mean, we need to change the players that we're producing in order to get noticed, I suppose.
But they even said to themselves, why England? Why are Irish players so fascinated with the English game? If I was a young Irish player or young coach and I wanted my players to look at the English game, I'd say, look at Swansea, look at Southampton, look what they're doing. They're trying something a little bit different. And they're succeeding. I'd get them to look at the Spanish and particularly the German league, which is fantastic. You know, we have this total fascination with the English league. And I think it's an unhealthy one. You know, as you saw, I know the programme you're on about this, it was a local Dublin club and fixing trials. But I don't know if you've noticed that. I remember when I was growing up, kids got trials for Liverpool, United and Arsenal. In that programme, kids were getting trials for Championship clubs and Division One clubs. So Irish players have obviously fallen down the ranking in some way. I don't know why that is. Maybe it's because we're not producing the players that the English game demands. But I don't think we should be so caught up with the English game. I think I think there is far more opportunities in other countries for an Irish player. I'd love to see a young Irish player who's got a bit of good understanding of perception, some good technique, you know, good cognitive abilities, go to Holland and suddenly become a really top player there. Why not? Why doesn't this happen? Iceland have it. Iceland have players in Holland and in Italy and in England. Why can't Irish players do that? Why do we just have to go across the water?
Yeah, it seems to be the complete dominant effect which happens. And, you know, as you said, Mark, players do be so bitterly disappointed when they've gone on trials, but they haven't made it. And as you said, that brings the whole self-esteem issue into it as well.
Yeah, exactly. It kills your self-esteem. And I know from my experiences, I've had similar experiences younger, and it's you're not prepared for that. You have to prepare the child. And that's why if you have a performance-orientated motivation climate, you can prepare the child to deal with these setbacks and see these setbacks as opportunities, okay, to develop even further. If you come from a result-orientated one where you're used to winning all the time, then it's going to be very, very hard for you to deal with it. I remember I coached an under-17 Swedish international 2 years ago. It was very interesting because he was the best team in Sweden. They won all their games, and then he comes up to senior level and we're playing and I'm coaching him. And I realise he does not know where to stand on the pitch when he doesn't have the ball.
Yeah.
When the opposition, and I spoke to him and I realised after speaking to him, the reason is because he's been in the best team in Sweden. They've won all their games. They used to having the ball all the time. He had no idea when the opposition had the ball what position to take up. So he was eventually, he came from a result-orientated climate. They won everything. He was an under-17 Swedish international, yet he was only a 50% player. We had to actually start coaching him to where to stand on the pitch when the opposition had the ball, because he had no idea. And this is quite a classic case. So he went on trials, and he was sent back because of these reasons.
Unbelievable. It's something so, you know, deep before, I suppose, you develop into a player. It matters so much on the structures. Just before I let you go, Mark, tell us a little bit about this book you're writing. It's all about coaching and development.
I don't know if this book is a good idea or a bad idea, but through my blog I got, and my contact with a guy called Dan Abrahams, who's a sports psychologist in the UK, his publisher got in touch with me and asked me would I write a book. And the theme of the book is not about how I coach, but more how young players learn. That's the idea, because I think we concentrate too much on coaching. In fact, at young ages, I think coaching can be quite overrated as well. And it's not about what I coach or how I coach, it's how the players learn. And I think that's almost far more important, to identify how each individual player learns. So I'm trying to put this together. This came out of the blue. I have never thought of ever writing a book, ever. It was the furthest thing from my mind. I said yes, and I don't know, is it such a good idea now? But I'm going to give it a go, but I'm about quarter way through at the moment, but it's going to take a few more months.
Well, we wish you the very best of luck at that. Just for any of our listeners who want to have a read of your blog, what's the address?
It's, just Google footblogball.wordpress.com.
That's terrific. Footblogball.wordpress.com. Listen, Mark, thanks a million for joining us, and we hope to chat to you again very soon. And best of luck with the book, and indeed on your whole view of changing the way kids understand coaching and the huge task that you have in front of you. But no doubt, I think you'll be driven enough to make it a success.
Thanks very much.
If you'd like to sponsor, advertise, or simply get involved with any of the shows on TalkingSport.org, drop us an email to dave@TalkingSport.org. That's dave@TalkingSport.org. Now, FAI Cup champion Sligo Rovers have launched their season tickets for 2014. The last few years have been quite good for the bit of red, and I'm delighted to be joined by the Sligo Rovers media officer, Rory Houston. Rory, no doubt there's still a feel-good factor at the club, winning the cup, the perfect time, I suppose, to launch your season tickets.
Of course it is, Dave, yeah. Thank you very much for the intro. It's our 14th in a row winning trophies on Sligo, so I suppose we're trying to build on each year. We're launching our season tickets now this week, and I think there's a real feel-good factor, as you say. We're finding a host of players for the new campaign, and I think Ian Barraclough is really, really hopeful of bringing the league title back to Sligo again next year. So the plans are in place now, and we're hoping to put them into action the next number of weeks.
Yeah, I was reading this week that you're really getting with the times with the tickets, and you've jazzed up the season tickets a little bit. I think they're like credit cards.
Yes, we've been working in conjunction with Ticket Group, and our season ticket this year will actually commemorate our FAI Cup win. So it'll be a credit card kind of system. When you enter the ground, you scan your ticket on the way in. So it really will be a bit of a souvenir as well for supporters as well to collect the season ticket for future years. But it's also, I suppose, a reward for our fans who have spoken to us about the desire for an improved season ticket. And we always try and listen to their wants as well. At our AGM last year, our fans requested too that we have a new season ticket of where you can guarantee your seat in the showgrounds, where you're able to pick off whatever seat you want and that's your seat for the whole season. So we listened to that. At the time it wasn't feasible, but now we feel it's possible. So we brought that in as well for the first time, and I think the feedback now has been quite good. So we're delighted to do that as well. I think as a member-owned club, a club that's very much based in the community in Sligo, it's important to listen to your supporters and what they want in terms of running the club. So we're delighted to go with that this year. In terms of other pricing, our cheapest season ticket is €40 for our Super Rights, which are children under 12 years old, and it's vital for us. It's one of the most important things to make football affordable. So that's, you can't really get better than that with a ticket for €2.35 per game for children. In terms, our adult tickets are the same price for third year in a row, which again is very, very, very important. And of course, we have a concession as well for school children, OAPs, students as well. So, you know, we really feel that Sligo Rovers is it's an open door for supporters. We want them to come to the showground each and every week and try and get behind the team. It really has worked in the last 4 or 5 years. The crowds have been rising every single year.
Yeah, the competitive prices, I was just thinking about what you were saying there. The competitive prices, I think, is quite evident. And I know there is a lot of League of Ireland clubs that are embracing this method. I know the FAI certainly did with the FAI Cup final, you know, getting people into the ground that normally wouldn't follow the soccer. You guys are probably implementing something similar.
Well, yeah, but at the same time, you kind of have to value your products. I think at Sligo Rovers, we feel we're one of the leading clubs in Ireland, but it's also important to reward our fans' loyalty as well. That's why we don't increase our prices, but we do feel that our entrance fee of €15 per game, our season tickets are €200, you know, it's a fair deal for 17 matches in a season. So I think we try and give as much incentive as possible. We do several promotions over the course of the year. At the very moment, we're discussing a family ticket as well, which hopefully will be able to implement during the season too. So, you know, there's no reason for people of Sligo, the people of other counties such as Mayo, Donegal, Roscommon, Galway, County there to come on board as well, because as you see for our ad for our season tickets, we're promoting our tickets in 15 outlets this year, not just Sligo. Sligo Rovers is not about Sligo, it's about the surrounding counties. It's about, it can be the whole of Ireland as well. We feel the club has massive, massive potential to grow, and that's why we have branched out to the likes of Castlebar, Bundoran, Ballyshannon, Carrickmacshannon, as I said. So like, it's important for us to be there and try and give our supporters the best possible chance to get season tickets.
It's quite remarkable the areas that you're tapping into. You mentioned there like the likes of Mayo, Roscommon, Leitrim, Donegal, Galway. A lot of these counties would have been traditionally a GAA stronghold, but I suppose as there's no real dominant, we've seen the demise of Galway United there over the past 2 years. It really is an opportunity, and with the success that Sligo Rovers have had recently, Rory, that this really has provided you with the platform to do so.
It does. You mentioned GAA backgrounds, but Ireland, you know, soccer in Ireland is a massive sport, huge sport. It rivals GAA in my eyes. So I think it's crying out for a team like Sligo Rovers to be able to give people the option to come see some of the best football in the land. You know, we're very happy with our products. We see our team are among the best in the country. So that's why we kind of branch out into such counties, because we feel there's a want and there need there. In Mayo, like, I know, I lived in Mayo for a while. I know the passion there. It's amazing. So that's why we're in Castlebar. That's why we're in the area there. And to be honest, the support is growing and growing. More and more supporters come from the likes of Mayo and Donegal. So when we go there, we really hope to get a big uptick this year in season tickets. And we have players that are from the county as well, which is a big help. We have David Cawley, who was on the fringes of the under-21 squad for Ireland. Of course, our most famous export is Seamus Coleman from Donegal, who went to Everton, and that's been a big help as well. It's really put Rovers on the map in Donegal. So you've seen more supporters come from that as well. So it's a big help. And as I say, it's more of a building process too, because you kind of add all these things together, and the more and more building blocks you put on, the bigger the club becomes. So we're going to kind of do that as much as possible and keep it going, you know.
And you've made, I think, a credit that has to go to Sligo Rovers is you guys have made it very easy for people in those surrounding counties to get their hands on tickets. I was looking up on the Sligo Rovers website and I've seen you guys have tickets available across all these different counties, Roscommon, Leitrim, Mayo. Really is remarkable. I suppose that kind of productivity is always going to gain more fans, and as you said, you're ever expanding.
Yeah, we have a host of promotional events that will be coming up for the next number of weeks as well to, you know, let people know in those areas that we are coming and we do want to support as well. And of course, we have slagrovers.com, where supporters can buy tickets online, which is probably the best way to do it as well, because you can buy it from your own home or your workplace and the like. In terms of Mayo, Leitrim and Donegal, like, we have our outlets there, and the outlets are in some of the best shops, such as like Jerry Kenny Sports and Castlebar. So, you know, the evidence will be there. So I think in the next number of weeks, we're really hopeful of a big uptick. And last season, we averaged close on 2,500 supporters every single game, and we really want to improve on that. And the more people you get through the gate, the more you can kind of grow the club. I think it's very important to us that we're a full-time club, we're professional, we try and do things right, and the best way to do it is to get more supporters through the gate. So that's our aim for the next
season. It is indeed, Rory. And I suppose one thing that a lot of Sligo Rovers fans will feel that you guys have done right is the likes of Evan McMillan, Aaron Green, Rafael Cretero signing new contracts, and indeed a signing of a very good player in Paul O'Connor from Drogheda.
Indeed, well, we're now at 10 players in the squad, and tomorrow we'll be announcing two more on Thursday, so we're looking forward to that as well. So they have 12 players now. I think it's a very good bit of business with 3 weeks gone in November. So it's a long time until the season begins, and already the squad has taken shape. But the players that have come in, Paul O'Connor is an excellent player from Drogheda. He had a remarkable performance in the cup final. He was very unlucky to lose that day against Sligo Rovers, ironically. Danny Ledwoods was a very good young player from Shamrock Rovers, who our manager Ian Barnclough has spoken about not getting the chance he deserves there, and he feels Sligo Rovers is the best possible move for him. So again, that's exciting to bring him into the club. And the 8 players you retained so far, they're all quality players. You know, you have Rafael Otero, David Cawley, Ross Gaynor. They're all top quality players. So we're very confident next season of trying to continue our trend of bringing trophies to the showground.
One of the things that I think a lot of followers of the Airtricity League will make the point that over the past few years, it has seemed to be so competitive. A couple of years ago, when Shamrock Rovers had the league win and they had all their fantastic performance in Europe, a lot of people were saying they're going to go so far ahead of the rest of the League of Ireland. But then Sligo Rovers won the Airtricity League there last year, playing the best football in Ireland, it's probably fair to say. And yet, again, this year it was St. Patrick's Athletic. So it really has been an exciting few years for the League of Ireland. And no doubt, even though you won the Cup this year and didn't win the league, there's still a lot of excitement around the club, as it's so unpredictable.
Well, there is. I think it's one of the great things about the League of Ireland is that a lot of the teams are all an even keel. You know, I think next season, our manager has already spoken about the ability of six or seven teams to be able to challenge for the title. I think people may have perceived the Shamrock Rovers were going to dominate, but I don't think they were saying that themselves. I think it's all about putting together a squad, trying to get a winning formula, and, you know, budgets, why there's a lot rest on that. It's all about trying to win games, and I think, in credit to our management team, to what they've done. So next season now, we're hopeful of challenging again. As I say, we've won several trophies in the last number of years, but you can't take it for granted either. Each season has had its ups and downs. Each season has had its high points at the same time. So we've managed to come out on top in the end in terms of the League or Cup, and we want to keep that going. Next year, we have the same path. We're trying to defend our league title. We found it quite difficult, admittedly, this year to try and defend our title. It didn't happen in the end, and Pats came out on top. But next year, Pats had to face that challenge themselves. So maybe there's a small bit of pressure off us. We had the height of our cup win, and hopefully now we can make a challenge at the league again.
Yeah, we wish Sligo Rovers the very best of luck. And Rory, just before I let you go, it must be terrific for the club to have the Ireland under-21s. They've found a real home at the showgrounds.
It's something we're very proud of. I think the manager, Noel King, made it his intention to base the club, or base the team there, and he spoke very highly of our facilities, the Clarion Hotel. He spoke highly of the showgrounds, of IT Sligo, and the players love the support they get from the showgrounds crowd. I think the Germany game was a disappointing result against a high-quality team, but the support for the team that day was quite amazing, and after their excellent result in Montenegro last night, we're really hopeful that the under-21s can make a big stride the next number of months, and at Sligo Rovers, we're delighted to be behind them. We're delighted to try and find them a home, and hopefully the future of Irish football will be very bright in Sligo.
Onwards and upwards. Just for people indeed looking to find more information on these season tickets that you guys have launched, what's the best thing?
The best way is to go to sligoovers.com. We will have our outlets there, our 15 outlets, and of course the easiest way is to buy online on our club website, and of course our club Twitter feed at Sligo Rovers and our Facebook page will have all the details. So as I said, if anybody ever needs any kind of information on tickets, we're happy to answer on our social media pages. And we're happy that our website will be able to fulfil the needs of season tickets as well.
Fantastic. Well, Rory Houston, we wish you the best of luck for the season ahead. And thanks a million for joining us on the Why Big Football Show.
No problem, Dave. Thank you.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time here on the Why Big Football Show. My thanks to Joe McCarty, Peter Staunton, Rory Houston, Mark O'Sullivan and Paul Moriarty. We'll do it all again very, very soon. Remember to check out us on Twitter at TalkingSport.org. That's at TalkingSport.org. We're TalkingSport.org on Facebook, and you can email Dave at TalkingSport.org. Chat to you soon, lads. Thanks a million.